Hello, and welcome to episode 7 of Awin Talks, the affiliate marketing podcast, and a belated Happy New Year to you all. We missed out on recording an episode in January thanks to a busy start to 2019, but we're back now with a new episode to kickstart the year. I'm joined once again by my colleagues Kevin and Craig.
Hello.
Hello.
And we'll shortly be discussing the recently published Predictions White Paper, which focuses on what trends and developments are likely to influence the global affiliate industry over the coming months. After that, Kevin will be talking with two prominent industry figures in the shape of performance agency acceleration partners Helen Southgate and fellow network optimizers Nathan Salter about the state of collaboration within the affiliate industry. It's a topic that's being heavily discussed right now across digital channels amid a series of seismic changes and challenges that arguably require the collaboration of competing businesses to resolve them. Kevin will be asking how the affiliate industry can pursue a similar cause and what the benefits and advantages of this objective might be. So, without further ado, let's kick things off with our discussion on the Predictions White Paper. This year's predictions piece included 10 forecasts for the global affiliate industry, taking into account a mix of macro factors, including international trade agreements and the pending rollout of the 5G network, alongside more industry-specific developments, such as the increasing consolidation that we've seen for some affiliate businesses and the impact of some of the enforced tracking changes we've also recently witnessed from certain web browsers. So I've asked the guys to pick out a particular prediction that they wanted to talk about here. And Kevin, you're going to kick things off for us.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, Rob. So I'm going to start with our eighth prediction, which was that affiliates' proximity to consumers will insulate them from digital deadheading. A phrase that I believe you came up with yourself.
I'm quite proud of that one.
Yes. Okay. So just to give people a bit of a synopsis about this topic. So it's a topic I think that we've been highlighting through various articles and pieces of content over the past year or so. And in a nutshell, it's the idea that affiliates have a degree of insulation because of their proximity to consumers. We often quote Mark Pritchard from Procter & Gamble. It's now been a couple of years since he made that infamous or famous speech where he said that the digital supply chain was murky at best and fraudulent at worst. Well, we took some comfort from that, I think, as an affiliate industry, because we are transparent and very results orientated. But he more recently, I think it was in January this year, he gave his latest thoughts in a recent interview in which he talked about how he's transforming the FMCG giant into one, to use his words, that is constantly connected to the consumer. And so P&G is doing this by removing some of the agencies, vendors, third parties they work with. I think from memory, they've kind of almost cut them in half, the number of suppliers that they're using. And instead, they're forming kind of smaller, more agile internal R&D teams around their products that will give them a more direct link to their consumers. So in the white paper, Rob, you make a specific correlation with this approach and the huge increase we've seen in direct-to-consumer brands such as Dollar Shave Club. Again, I think as affiliate marketers, we can take some solace from this. As we know, affiliates have created some of the most compelling direct-to-consumer propositions themselves. Cashback sites, employee portals, voucher platforms, blogs, comparison sites, and so on. They're all obviously designed to empower consumers to get great deals, but also make more informed choices about what they purchase. And we know, obviously, that consumers seek these sites out in their millions, and they continue to be hugely popular. On that, I'm looking forward to seeing what the IAB produce later on this year. So every year they carry out a survey of UK consumers in conjunction with YouGov, and they kind of assess how consumers are interacting with digital services and the benefit they derive from them. And there's always a couple of questions around, specifically around affiliate marketing services. It's always shown that the majority of consumers interact with an affiliate-minded service at least once every 6 months. So I think again that kind of adds to the picture for us about consumers' engagement. A note of caution, though, just to finish, I don't feel that generally affiliates sell their services that well. I don't think they ever have done. I mean, some there are obviously exceptions to that rule, but I think this year what I'd like to see is more of them step up and create more compelling visions of how their propositions connect consumers to the brands that they promote.
Yeah, I think that's like a really interesting subject. And it really, again, like you said, it kind of emphasizes the value that affiliates have in building up that relationship because of their proximity with consumers directly. And when it serves almost as a counterpoint, I guess, to something, a theme that we focused on a lot in last year's content, which was around the value chain that's involved, or the protracted chain that's involved between advertiser to consumer or to publisher in, for instance, the programmatic landscape, where there's all these intermediaries and there's a huge amount of mediation that goes on with the various parties involved in the online advertising industry. That is under a lot of scrutiny right now. There's a lot of criticism from various bodies, and I know journalists have been looking into it a lot. And I think that when you're talking about the rise of direct-to-consumer tactics from a marketing perspective, affiliates are really a good example of that, because you've got consumers who are available practically directly through these kind of publisher models, and they've built up that relationship with those consumers, and they can provide relevant messaging for brands directly to them, and I think that that's something that does hold the channel in good stead.
Yeah, I mean, so by that admission, do you think other companies are going to take the same route as Procter & Gamble in terms of, you know, speaking directly with consumers in terms of the R&D side of things and that with their products? Or
I think potentially there's definitely, from a lot of the bigger brands, I think that they've, with the amount of scrutiny that's gone into you know, notions around ad fraud over the last 18 months to 2 years, particularly in that digital landscape, there's been a lot of kind of reviewing, I guess, of the processes and the platforms that they use and the investments that they've made historically. And they're now beginning to wonder whether or not they're getting value from a lot of those partnerships that have been placed. And there's been kind of like an extent to which they're trying to wrest back control, I guess, over how their ad budgets are being spent and where their brand is being positioned online by partners that they don't necessarily have a direct relationship with. Mm. So whether or not that investment goes into in the same way that P&G are looking to kind of innovate internally and have these, like you say, R&D teams develop stuff internally that can provide them with a means of doing that, or whether they look to kind of shift it into alternative channels, perhaps performance, but like through affiliates, or perhaps, as I'll go on to kind of talk about shortly, into something like Amazon, which gives you, again, kind of presence on a marketplace platform, which has a direct relationship with the consumers, because that's where a lot of the consumers are now shifting when they're looking for those types of product. Mm. So shifting on to, yes, another prediction, we can cover mine last.
Okay. It's your piece, I suppose.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I mean, when it comes to the point I'm going to be talking about today, really is around what we discussed slightly last year, which we feel, is going to be, it's going to have some impact on online in general and affiliates as well, which is, of course, the ever increasing tax scrutiny that governments have on online companies. Now, there's generally a two pronged approach to this. I know that we discussed it a little bit last year with the introduction of the Nexus tax in the US. Well, the ruling in the US, which changed the way that the Nexus tax worked in the US, which was around in June time last year. But there is also a move globally to do this. So, I mean, in France, they've actually brought in some digital tax this year. The UK want to do this, but the actual reading up on the UK one, it's slightly different. And actually, it breaks some EU laws, so it isn't necessarily possible to do until...
Don't have to worry about those.
Well, exactly, until the UK exits the European Union. So yeah, the two reasons generally are, obviously, the one is that there is a feeling that there is a lot of tax revenue not gained from online businesses, and there is also a lot of tax avoidance that goes on with online businesses. That's not just at the top, medium-sized businesses do as well. So avoiding sales tax in the US was one, but also in other countries as well where that happens. And the other is, of course, trying to save, and this happens globally, is trying to save the high street. You know, Mike Ashley came out, I think it was late last year in the select committee that were discussing this, and he kind of outlined that unless the government does tax online businesses, at least he wants them to tax like 20%. Or something similar to that.
Unless they do. Just for context, and any global audience listeners, explain who Mike Ashley is.
You want the so
potted version.
Yeah. Okay, we'll do the cleaner version. Yeah. So no, he's he's a quite controversial figure, a billionaire that owns Sports Direct, owns Newcastle United Football Club, and now owns House of Fraser. Have I forgotten any? I don't know.
Probably by the time this comes out, he's probably bought another couple.
He probably bought another couple of high street chains, struggling high street chains. But he, I mean, you know, he does have a passion for the high street. He does say that, you know, he does want his, I mean, obviously his high street businesses. But he says, but basically what he says, if 20% of your sales are online as any retailer, you should be taxed a certain digital tax on that. That's kind of what he said, and there's other kind of prominent figures as well that have come out and said things. So Bill Gates as well, obviously Bill Gates being, you know, founder of Microsoft, huge in the online history and in the history of the online world anyway. He came out yesterday saying that if you want more firms to pay tax online, you need a change in law, because otherwise you're not going to get what you want as a government. Mm. You know, I think, and then obviously the EU is discussing taxes around the large internet giants. I think the UK is more focused around the retail side of it. So they want to be taxing to make it competitive for retail on offline still. Okay. And then, of course, I think in countries like France and Germany, they want the tax revenue from the people like Google that are kind of seemingly getting away with not paying tax. It all has an effect effectively on the ecosystem anyway. These large the large giants, if they start to get squeezed for tax, they may well put up their prices and the way that they operate. Also, which obviously affects all of us. And of course, if taxes come in on consumers, that face consumers through online, so things like a sales tax, that can obviously affect the price and competitiveness of online companies. And so again, that affects the ecosystem again. I mean, I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but I mean, my opinion is I think that, yes, I agree with taxing companies like that, but I mean, when it comes to saving retail offline, I don't think that's necessarily the only thing that needs to happen. There needs to be a change in the way that retail offline works, because I don't think it's just about price or cost for those businesses. Effectively, you know, consumers find it easier to shop online now, and there has to be a reason for them to shop offline that they don't get for their online kind of thing. So I suppose, you know, it's for me, it's a kind of dual-pronged approach, really. I don't know about what your thoughts are anyway.
Well, I mean, I find it quite interesting at the moment that this is almost part of a wider attempt by individual sovereign states to try to regulate, to try to legislate against some of the issues that we've seen from these global online companies, where the internet obviously has no borders. These companies have instant access to audiences and consumers right across the globe. So how does a national state try to regulate that, and how does it try to tax an organization like that that is maybe providing, you know, services to the local population but is actually based outside of its geographical borders? And I heard there was a lawyer that I was listening to on a podcast recently refer to this type of legislation as turning the web into the splinter net. So I'm wondering whether or not that's going to be a term that we kind of hear more, because essentially you're talking about kind of fracturing something that it has up until now been relatively kind of global and relatively seamless. And you've seen kind of companies, you know, a lot of the companies that we work with who have been successful have looked to try and grow their brand by operating overseas and by trying to kind of engage consumers in other kind of nations. And I would presume that these changes in the way that you can operate in those individual countries, whether it be through taxation, whether it be through data regulation, et cetera, if they're being kind of tailored individually, then that's another obstacle for businesses to be able to expand globally, and it's another obstacle for them to kind of operate in those new territories. So that's quite interesting.
I suppose that's one of the reasons why what the EU does is so interesting, important. I mean, regardless of what you think about it, it's incredibly powerful, because you're talking about 500 million consumers, many of whom are quite wealthy. You know, it's a hugely attractive trading block, which, well, obviously we don't necessarily think that in the UK anymore, but that aside. But taking that on board, you know, what they do, they do have the ability to actually impact a very large trading block. So I think also for me, we know that, you know, we've talked about it in various pieces and white papers, etc. We know that there are these huge amount of external pressures, and a lot of them are based around kind of different things. So you've got the various different pieces of EU legislation around, you know, obviously got GDPR, we've got the privacy directive, these tax issues, all of them kind of are coalescing at the same time. And I think for me, what will be interesting is that this is kind of the first concerted attempt to tackle what is perceived to be like redressing the balance. It almost feels as though the scales have tipped too far in one direction, and now we're trying to rebalance it. And it'll be interesting to see, a lot of these are kind of first step attempts. And I think depending on the success of these or the outcome of these, it'd be interesting to see how that informs future legislation, and whether legislators and regulators will kind of have their tails up off the back of this and think, you know, that's been a success. Obviously, they can be quite blunt instruments, some of this legislation. It ignores some of the kind of nuance. But it'd be interesting to see whether, off the back of the successes or otherwise of this legislation, it'd be interesting to see whether there's maybe like a bit of a snowball effect behind this and what the impact is. Because this isn't just non-US companies attacking US companies, because we will see more regulation coming out of the US. And, you know, the US does want to tackle, you know, we've heard that you know, the huge US retailers have gone to the wall recently, and there is this push coming from the US as well. So I think it'll be really interesting to see how all of those different kind of individual pieces of legislation actually inform general discussion, and whether there will be more consistent approaches globally.
Mm. Yeah, it's weird. The US is normally quite anti-tax historically, but they kind of led the way on it in a way, because the EU is still struggling to pass its tax law, because the tax havens within the EU don't want it. So the Irish and the likes of Ireland and Liechtenstein are vetoing these attempts. So they've kind of moved a bit quicker than the rest of it, but everyone else. But once once the US and the EU start doing it, everyone has to follow suit anyway, regardless of how open border the internet is. If the two biggest continents economically in the world start doing that, then, you know, you have to take note.
Well, I imagine that one of the targets for these initiatives, tax initiatives at the moment, will be inevitably Amazon. And Amazon is the prediction I wanted to focus on from the report, which from the white paper. So the third prediction we made was that Amazon will represent a big threat to affiliates in 2019. So whilst Google and Facebook's duopoly often takes a lot of the headlines in the digital industry for hoovering up the vast majority of online ad spend around the world, Amazon have actually been quietly growing their own advertising platform over the last couple of years. And 2019, I think, could well be the year that its impact is really felt by the wider ecosystem, including affiliates. Last year, Amazon moved above Oath and Microsoft as the third highest digital ad seller in the US, behind the duopoly now. And with the website cultivating a huge amount of first-party consumer data, particularly through the success of its Prime membership, it's in a really strong position to further monetize that data via advertising. The growth of its membership scheme has really mirrored a similar growth in the habits of consumers to turn directly to Amazon as well when searching for products online. And in doing so, they cut out a lot of the valuable affiliate businesses that would have traditionally played a role in helping connect users to the brands that they're seeking out. And it effectively turns Amazon into a walled garden of e-commerce without recourse to the wider web. So with more people heading straight to Amazon's marketplace for their goods directly, advertisers are obviously increasingly compelled to invest in boosting their own profile on the platform. Therefore, more ad spend is being funneled into what we might soon be calling a triopoly, with the distribution of that spend dwindling to an ever smaller set of players. And that's investment which may well be cut from the affiliate channel. And in doing so, I think it really undercuts the opportunity to invest in a channel which has historically been a champion of new innovation, of entrepreneurs and small businesses, which all play a really pivotal role in sustaining a diverse digital environment, and one which actively cultivates rather than inhibits ideas and notions around competition. So it would be really fascinating, I think, to see over the next 12 months what the impact of Amazon's advertising platform is and how advertisers respond to, you know, this new opportunity for them to seek out customers. And like you were mentioning with your prediction earlier, Kev, the fact that they can reach them directly when they know that they're in a mental frame of mind for buying products makes it all the more compelling, I think, as an ad investment. So it's going to be interesting, but potentially challenging from the affiliate industry's perspective.
Yeah, I think that it's from an affiliate marketing perspective, it's about creating or maintaining a point of difference. It's about us being able to say, because a lot of advertisers don't like the fact that their choices are becoming more limited in terms of how the channels that they can go through, and but the more money that you spend with kind of a smaller group of partners means that the more powerful they are, potentially the less leverage you have around cost and price, etc. I think from an affiliate perspective, what's beholden on for networks, and the responsibility and a key priority for networks has to be to continue to offer new and interesting and viable solutions. And I think that we will see, certainly it's a priority for Awin, and I think we'll see a desire to want to expand beyond sort of traditional affiliate relationships and try and incorporate more and more avenues and routes to market for brands, so that you can offer new and interesting opportunities beyond the kind of the standard stuff that's available.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I mean, it is genuinely about trying to differentiate, really. I think that there is a thing to be said, I suppose, in some sectors this isn't really going to be a thing. I mean, fashion, Amazon really hasn't taken off with its fashion side of things. I know it did attempt to, so it does sell clothing online, and I know people do buy it, but in terms of like its growth, it hasn't been as big, I don't think. So there are some protected sectors, aren't there?
But where do you buy your clothes from, Craig?
Co-op. No. I can actually tell you where I actually buy my clothes from.
Sorry, I don't need to answer that question.
Yeah, I'm not going to answer that. I think with so some sectors, as I say, will be protected by it. But yes, we will see more of a dominance, won't we, from that kind of ecosystem. So.
It's kind of a bit of a sort of happening a little bit under the radar, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely over the last, I'd say, you know, 6 to 12 months, they've started to gather momentum, and it's started to make a few more headlines in terms of some of the industry news sites. But I think the fact that it's growing so quickly it's almost a bit of a year of reckoning for Amazon and in terms of their advertising platform. So this is the year, I think, where it could really break out, and we could really start to see more and more advertisers shift substantial budget into boosting their profile on there.
So for this month's interview, we've got not one but two guests, both of whom are, I hope they don't mind me saying, industry veterans. We've got Helen Southgate from Acceleration Partners and Nathan Salter from Optimize, who are here to discuss with me the concept of industry collaboration. But before we get into the meat of the topic, I'll get them to quickly say hello and introduce themselves. So Helen, if you'd like to go first.
Sure. Thanks, Kevin. Hi, everyone. I'm Helen Southgate. I'm Managing Director for EMEA for Acceleration Partners. We're an affiliate marketing consultancy agency. We help clients build better affiliate programs.
And Nathan, over to you.
Hi there. Thanks for inviting me along. So I'm Nathan Salter. I work for a company called Optimize Media Group. We're based in the UK, up in Norwich, and we've got offices in a number of different other countries. I'm the COO, and I've been working in the industry for pretty much going on 2 decades now.
Thanks both. So we've known each other for a number of years, and one of the things I think that we've mainly connected over is that our businesses have been closely involved with the various iterations of the Performance Marketing Council, which really remains as only the only place that industry players come together regularly to tackle issues that affect us. And I thought this is kind of a bit of a timely discussion as far as I'm concerned, because recently we kind of collaborated as an industry with other players as well to send out communication about ITP, which we all signed our names to, encouraging advertisers to ensure they had fit for purpose tracking. And secondly, because there's a potential opportunity this year to devise a gold standard around affiliate marketing. So with that in mind, with that kind of backdrop, Helen, if I can start with you, and Nathan, feel free to chip in. How important do you think it is for us as an industry to collaborate, especially because you know, Nathan works as a competitor company to Awin. So, Helen, why do you think it's important for businesses to collaborate?
Yeah, well, I think as a business, you can take two views on this. So you can take the view of let's collaborate, with the reasons being, you know, it could be protection, it could be growth, it could be lobbying, it could be anything. But the kind of ultimate objective of that is that you kind of grow the pie or protect the pie for everyone, right? That's the reason people collaborate, and, you know, businesses, huge competitive businesses, do it all the time. It's quite standard. Or you can take the other view where, you know, you go out alone because you see that as a competitive advantage and, you know, you don't collaborate and you kind of just do your own thing. But I think, you know, what we've seen over the years, and particularly in affiliate marketing, is that when we come together as a group of, yes, competitors and peers and, you know, sometimes friends to try and do good for the industry, it works really well. Like, if I think back to just before Christmas, I mean, we had Awin in the room, Trade Doubler in the room, Rakuten, Optimize, you know, all fierce competitors day to day, but, you know, we were able to come to an agreement around what we thought was best for the future of the affiliate marketing industry and you know, really make progress and waves to do that. And I think those companies that do not want to get involved in that, I think will actually probably get left behind, because I think we'll kind of go ahead and probably be much more successful.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. I think, you know, nobody's giving away their trade secrets as part of talking with one another. I think we've, over the years, we've tend to be a lot of the same characters that are involved in this, the same businesses, and I think we've pretty much got the measure of each other in respect to being able to have sensible conversations. You have to remember, of course, that within our industry, there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of potential for confusion, a lot of publisher overlap that works with all of the networks and all of those companies that are having these conversations. And I think it's just one of those things that it becomes a sensible thing to align thinking. It doesn't mean we all have to conclude the same things, but it certainly makes sense to listen to each other and talk about these agendas.
Yeah, and I also think, you know, people often think, you know, collaboration is about everyone agreeing on something, which isn't actually the case, and it shouldn't be the case. If everyone agrees on something, it's normally not a good thing. Like, you have to have people objecting and putting their own arguments, you know, you have to question each other. Like, that's the whole point of collaboration. It's not just all us. I think people have the perception that we all sit in a room and agree on how the industry should be forward for our own benefit, but it's not. You know, we really challenge each other and we move the industry forward for everyone's benefit. And I think that's sometimes, you know, misunderstood about how we actually do this.
I think conceptually as well, there are certain topics that it transcends the business. So if you take ITP, for example, that is something that's completely beyond any of our control. Yeah. But all of us have technology. It might be different technology, but all of us have solutions in place. So it's about addressing kind of the wider those bigger issues.
Yeah. And I think maybe that's a really good example of perhaps how, you know, the impact of not collaborating as early as we should have done last year was. Because if you think about some of the mixed messages which are coming out from the industry, you know, some companies were saying there would be no impact of ITP. They were like, don't worry about it, there'll be no impact, everything will track. Whereas other companies were saying, actually, yeah, this is going to be a serious impact. You know, it's going to affect 15-20% plus of sales. And then, you know, publishers were already seeing drops. And there was just so much like miscommunication and confusion because we probably were a bit late to it, which we all kind of realized at the end of last year and got together. But that's a negative effect of not collaborating. You get all these mixed messages and mixed signals. And it's really unfair on the publisher base as well. I mean, you know, this is their bread and butter. This is kind of their earnings. And, you know, we have to be able to come together as an industry, I think, to do that and not kind of confuse everybody and give mixed messages.
Yeah, I think some good points there, Helen. The ITP one was interesting because there were conversations that were going on within the industry for quite a long time before anything really significant was done about it. And by that, I mean the communication that you're referring to, Kevin, which I guess is pretty significant, is all of those competitors coming together with a single position. And, you know, I think there's sometimes just part of the process that it takes a lot of discussion and working things out before it gets to the point, before it gets to the point of actually being able to move forward. And, you know, thankfully, I think anyway, that the industry is joined up enough so that these conversations do go on, that there, as well as having these formal formats within the IAB and so on, there's also that trickle of conversation which sometimes has to build up as a precondition of actually making something happen. So I agree, we could have moved faster, and there are other things that we could move more decisively on. But I think if we didn't have the collaboration and discussion that we do have, I think it'd be a lot worse, actually.
So we touched on ITP there, but there are obviously a large number of other issues, probably more issues now than there ever have been, threats coming from all sides. So with that in mind, what are the kind of particular issues or initiatives that you would like to see us prioritise as an industry?
Go ahead.
I think one of the things is something that's been raised by a lot of publishers recently is around payments. So I always feel like we plug James Little when we do these things. It's a bit annoying, isn't it? Hi, James. But, you know, James has quite openly been quite frustrated about it. And actually, I guess this is the other point about collaboration. It doesn't have to be through the Performance Marketing Council as it is now. You know, James has kind of set up a publisher group which are trying to collaborate together to approach this issue of, you know, kind of slow and late payments, which I think is fair. And I'm sure it'll end up bubbling up to the Performance Marketing Council at some point anyway, which, you know, I think is only a good thing. So I think we certainly need to try and tackle that. I think it's an issue that's probably been ongoing for quite a while, and it really does affect publishers. And I think particularly, you know, again, like the two things I always talk about, always plug James Little and always mention Brexit. That's really fun. But, you know, we're going into a really uncertain period, and I think we need to, as an industry, make sure we really protect the people within our industry, and payments is going to be one of those. And, you know, who knows what's going to happen over the next 6-12 months? You know, the world economy is going to change. Lots of things are going to happen. And I think, you know, it's really important for us to make sure that the basics happen and they happen well. So that's kind of one area. And I think the other area is really around kind of regulation, but particularly around transparency. So, you know, I think in terms of how we work together as an industry to manage disclosure and commercial relationships is going to be a really big challenge that we're going to have to think about quite carefully and, you know, put some brains together as an industry and how we do that. Because, you know, we have hundreds of thousands of affiliates in the space, and in reality, they're probably not disclosing how they should be at the moment. And I think that's an area we're going to have to tackle through regulation anyway.
Yeah, I would say, you know, that expands out to the wider standards agenda, where over the last few years, there's been so many issues, regulatory threats and so on, scrutiny from standard agency. Not so much of it necessarily on the affiliate and performance part of the industry, but certainly a lot of scrutiny and a lot of perceived threats, some of those with existential threats. And it's caused a reaction. It's meant that there's been, I think, a sort of magnified focus on these standards, and which all sounds great, but from the affiliate point of view, I think what the risk is that the rest of the industry moves on and it formalizes and it makes sure that it has these standards that it can point at and demonstrate and use to defend its activities and how it operates. And I think the risk is that the affiliate part of the industry, which operates in some ways the same, but in other ways very, very different, it's going to be left a little bit on the outside. My own view is that it needs to demonstrate a bit more maturity, a bit more ability to address its own standards agenda, not necessarily because there are big issues, but just because I think there is a requirement to show your professional creds to the outside world, whether that's regulators or whoever's looking at us, really, wherever that scrutiny is coming from.
Yeah, and I also think if I speak to any brands at the moment, clients, one of their biggest concerns, I think, is around transparency. You know, it's on everyone's agenda at the moment, and it will be the thing that stops brands working in affiliate marketing if we don't get it right. So if we can't give advertisers transparency about exactly where their ads are being placed, where their traffic is coming from, how they're generating sales, it will only be a detriment to the whole industry anyway. So it's something that we have to tackle.
So what does that look like in practice? Is it us creating our own set, like standardized set of metrics? Obviously, we all generally we work to a CPA model, but there are kind of additional fees, tenancies, CPC payments. There's other kind of commercial models that exist. It's actually become quite complex. We work on a number as a business ourselves. We have a number of different commercial models. But does that therefore, are you saying that on a practical level we should be working towards something that's a bit more standardized from a measurement point of view and in the way that other industries do?
I don't necessarily think it's from a measurement point of view. I think it still comes down to trust. I mean, the digital industry has been rocked a lot, and advertisers are very mistrustful of any digital marketing at the moment, like still, to be honest with you. And affiliate marketing, as much as I think we've worked very hard to get rid of that, I think there's still an element of it there. And, you know, if we think about a few discussions that have come up recently, you know, one of them is around sub-networks, and there's some big frustrations from clients around the lack of transparency there, which I think is fair. And I think, you know, it's something that we have tackled in the past, but for whatever reason, you know, it's come up again and we need to tackle it. I also think, you know, just advertisers being able to understand where their ads are being displayed and where their brand is being talked about, you know, it's hard when you work with hundreds of affiliates potentially, but I think we need to kind of find some better ways to do that. So it's not necessarily the metrics. I think it's still, you know, how are people representing the brand, and are advertisers aware and happy with how they're representing the brand? That's what we need to just keep on top of it. I think generally we've been very good at it because we've had to as a channel, and you know, we've made a lot of improvements to best practice. We've stopped a lot of kind of areas of publishers like toolbars coming into the UK because we felt they don't add incremental value, and you know, advertisers potentially shouldn't be working with some of them. So we've done a lot of that. I just think we need to keep on top of it, and the only way we can do that is to continue to work together and kind of raise these issues and address them when they come up.
Yeah, I think it's, as you say, it's getting a closer grip on, if you like, those behavioural elements of the industry. I mean, there's technology changes quickly, new players come in to the space. There's always threats around the corner, and that need to adapt. And I think part of that process means that the boundaries can be pushed outwards a bit in terms of what's deemed as acceptable or how much transparency you want to actually give when actually your livelihood and your business depends on it. And I think the need for standards is such that it needs to allow for that elasticity within the space, but it does need to make sure that there are clear boundaries, and then we need, in terms of that oversight framework, we need that ability to sort of double back over the things that we've agreed. Do they need to be adjusted? Have things changed? What actually is enforcement looking like? Is it possible to enforce these things? And yes, it's an ongoing thing. It's never one of these things where you can just roll them out and forget about it. Things change far too quickly for that. So I think it's always going to be a fair bit of hard work.
In terms of I think we're all kind of on the same page that we all kind of obviously adhere to this idea of the fact that we do need to work collaboratively. But one of the criticisms that's been leveled at our businesses is that we're not necessarily representative of the wider industry. And obviously there are a number of different players. Affiliate is a microcosm of digital, so it incorporates a number of different channels within that as well. Obviously we work within the membership within the IAB as the Performance Marketing Council. But how do we address that? What are the ways that, one of the key criticisms is that publishers aren't represented enough. And Helen, you mentioned that James Little has started this new group of publishers. So how do we get people on side by saying to them that we are actually listening to them and we are actually representing their views?
Yeah, so I guess I'm slightly in two minds on this. So it's something that we've discussed at the IAB quite a number of times. And, I've always felt that publishers should have more of a voice there and some representation there. But that's much, it's a lot easier said than done, because there's literally hundreds and thousands of publishers. So how do you represent everybody? It's a very difficult thing to do. And, the IAB needs to be funded. So, can small publishers vote? Like, there's lots of challenges with that, and I think potentially setting up something outside the IAB for publishers might be a good thing. I guess the other thing is, though, I do think we've always been fairly open, and I think publishers can talk to their networks. They can talk to anybody on council. They can put things through performance in. There's lots of means for publishers to be able to get their views across. And I do think we've listened to all of those things over the years. I don't think we've ever ignored any problems that have come up ever. Not saying that we've always solved all the challenges or, it's been easy, but I don't think we've ever ignored everything. So, I think it's sometimes a bit of a harsh criticism to say that it's not inclusive, because I think we've always tried to make it inclusive to everybody. It's just, the channels that they go through. And I think we continue to do that. But if there's ways in which we can do that better, I think we'd always be open to that.
I think there are frameworks that exist for that. I mean, there are affiliate gets together. There's social media that's used where, there's forums where things are discussed. So I think the key players in the space do tend to make their opinions heard. Those opinions then get absorbed, and then they get carried into the meetings and the discussions that we've been talking about here. So, if you look at the number of players in the space, there really are a huge number, and it's never going to be practical to get large numbers involved. That's not to say that a few more of the key players should be heard a bit more. I think actually some of those key players, in terms of tangible outputs of these discussions, I think they sometimes lack a bit of patience and expect there to be silver bullets and for things to be created and happen overnight. And I think if there was a bit more acceptance that actually, there's a process, there's a bit of incubation that needs to go on to make these things happen. I'd like to think that we could get a few more of those players along and that they would stay the course, actually, which, it's another challenge that we face where there's a lot of interruption to dialogue because some of the good people with the views and ideas, that I think they lose patience and they drop out. So that's certainly a challenge that we need to address.
Yeah, and I think as well, Kev, I think you've said this a few times, you know, it's very easy to shout from the sidelines, but, you know, to actually get involved and make things happen takes, you know, some commitment and work and effort. And, you know, that's certainly personally been one of my frustrations being involved in, you know, collaboration over the years. Some people, you know, will talk a good game, but they don't want to put the time and commit into it. And, you know, that's really frustrating because, you know, I think collaboration is about everybody getting together and everybody using their resources and committing time and effort to do it. And, you know, there's been times where I've just thought, yeah, sod it, you know, people don't care enough anymore. And, you know, I think that's a challenge that hopefully we can overcome. But, you know, people have to take some responsibility as well. And, you know, if you want to make change happen, you have to do something about it. You can't just sit on the sidelines shouting. It doesn't really work like that.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got a few more minutes. There's a couple of other things I just wanted to talk about. So I kind of mentioned earlier to you, if you kind of had like a wish list of things that you wanted to do on a kind of, I suppose, pulling it down to some of the discussions that we've been having more recently on a practical level about initiatives that are coming up. What are the initiatives? If this time next year, for example, what would you consider to be success if we've achieved them as an industry?
I think the big one for me is, and you know, this is why, like, I know I've not always been hugely positive about the IAB over my time because I've had some frustrations, but one of the biggest advantages of working with them is that they can really help us understand what's going on in a wider digital industry, which I think is important because I think we are quite navel-gazing, but also, you know, really give us a platform to tell people about how great the affiliate industry is. And we haven't done that very well over the years. And I really think if we could, you know, make a kind of collaborative effort to do that, really use the resources that the IAB has, not just the IAB, you know, other kind of digital bodies and trade bodies and you know, trade magazines, etc., as well, to really sell the affiliate channel that, you know, it is very successful, it is a great return on investment, it is very transparent, you know, we have lots of best practices, it's extremely professional, there's huge brands that work in the market and there's huge publishers as well. You know, if we could achieve that, I think that would put us in a really, really good position for kind of end of this year and into 2020.
Yeah, I think you're talking about, you know, the things that have been hot topics of late, Helen. So again, I definitely agree with all of that. And really just to sort of layer onto that, if we could end up into, you know, through collaboration and discussion, end up in a position where we feel maybe a little less fringe, which we perhaps are at times, especially within the IAB. There's a tendency to focus on, kind of makes sense, where 80-90 probably more percent of the digital budget goes, and to overlook some of the other areas of the industry, such as affiliate and performance, which, you know, there's still a lot of money going through this part of the industry, and I think there's, you know, perhaps a lack of understanding the extent of the dovetailing between performance industry and, I guess, the non-performance industry, and you know, more and more we're seeing that performance is able to demonstrate its value in these areas. But it is quite a difficult thing to affect and achieve if there's still these hard lines in terms of the collaboration that goes on within the industry. So I guess I'm saying not only do we need to be able to collaborate more as an affiliate industry, a performance marketing industry, but as part of that, we need to be able to build bridges and connect with the wider industry. So if in a year's time we're much better at that, I think people would feel good about that, perhaps less frustrated, and more optimistic.
Yeah, I definitely think we've got a really positive story to tell. Yeah. It's just about us finding out how to do that effectively, because I don't think we've necessarily been brilliant as an industry at connecting. We're very good at the kind of the head stuff. You know, you can show the results on a spreadsheet and in a nice presentation, but in terms of connecting around stories and really compelling like brand campaigns and things like that, that's sometimes where we're a bit lacking.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely wouldn't want to put the full stop on this podcast and leave the impression that that it's not pretty good already. I think, you know, we're focusing very much on how we can improve things. I mean, the industry does do a lot. It comes together. It's into, you know, many different forms of digital advertising. And all we're really talking about here is taking stock of where we are and looking at how we can push that further. And, you know, there's a good team of people that that are hearing and listening to us at the IAB. And for those that, you know, aren't aware, there's an action plan which is in place to affect these things so that, you know, digital is more, if you like, accommodating of these idiosyncrasies of the performance marketing sector and allowing us that opportunity to really engage and push into those spaces.
And I think this is one of the great things about our industry, and I think why we've been so successful and, you know, perhaps why some other channels have struggled. Like, we never rest on our laurels. Like, we always want to be better. Like, it's already a great industry and we've done some great stuff, but we always think we can improve and we can always push it. And there's some really good people in the industry that, you know, have the kind of drive and commitment to do that because they want to make a change. And I'd also like to see, you know, more people get involved. I think that's the other thing. Like, if I was thinking about, so Kev, when you said about the affiliate marketing counts, and we've known each other for years, right? It must have been, what, over 10 years ago when we went to the first council. So I was maybe in my 20s. I'm not sure about you, Kev. You're maybe a bit older. And they, but like, we were like, where are those 20-year-olds? Do you know what I mean? Like, let's get some of those people involved. Let's get the young Kevin, Nathan, and Helen's involved. But, you know, it built our careers. You know, it really did. It developed us kind of within ourselves and our businesses. And I'd love to kind of see some more people get involved in the future as well.
Yeah, just on that, it's a tricky thing to know kind of how, if you do want to get involved and you're not a member of the IB. But what I would say is that if you log onto the IB website, they have a member directory. And if you search within that directory, hopefully you'll be able to find a company who is a member who you're familiar with or you work with. And so I would say reach out to those companies and ask them if they're in the performance space, how you can potentially get involved or lend your opinion or effort, because it's always much appreciated. We're kind of out of time now, so I just want to say thanks very much to Helen and Nathan for joining us today.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
A big thanks to Nathan and Helen for taking part in today's debate there, which I hope you found of interest. Before we finish up, I wanted to remind you again that you can find the Predictions White Paper on the Market Insights part of the AWIN site, where you can download the full paper for free if you're interested in reading more. And I also wanted to let you know that we're currently in the throes of putting together all of the various content for this year's brand new AWIN report. If you haven't come across it before, this is an annual publication that we compiled to give you a view on the state of the global affiliate industry. It's a bit of a beast. Last year's edition came in at about 170 pages, and we're expecting this one to weigh in at over 200. So it's a hefty piece of work, including articles from a diverse set of thought leaders in the industry, profiles on all of AWIN's global markets, and a wide selection of case studies and insights from a variety of our publisher and advertiser partners. We'll be launching it in mid-March, and you'll be able to download digital copies from the AWIN site for free. I'm sure we'll dedicate some time to discussing its content in more detail next month, so I'll leave you with that teaser for now. In the meantime, it's goodbye from me, it's goodbye from Kev.
Goodbye.
And goodbye from Craig.
Goodbye.